to introduce the first paper of the afternoon. Carmen is going to be presenting Reconstructing Narratives of the Dormant Language, the case of Chimari.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'll be talking today a little bit, it's kind of an extension of my dissertation. That was a long time ago. I worked on that language, but I wanted to continue working on the language because there's so much more to do. So today I'm going to present on kind of the next step that I'm working on. This is the structure of the talk. I'll give you a brief introduction. I'll talk a little bit about Chimeric, the language, and the nature of the data on the language. And then I'll take you through the steps that as I'm reconstructing the narratives to build a corpus, and I'll have some conclusions at the end. So what this talk is mainly about is to show you what you can do with data of a dormant language where you have a closed corpus to begin with, you have no speakers, the data may not be in its ideal status to work with, and but you can still do so much with it. So I want to encourage people who have those kinds of data with, for their languages, as part or all of the data that is available, to just show you what can be done. Some of the pitfalls in working with materials from archives are that you sometimes don't get whole translations. So you have translations that are imprecise, or if the researcher knows what the translation is supposed to be, sometimes the researcher just didn't write it down. You generally don't get nice interlinear translations as you would like to, and since you don't have any speakers left in a dormant language, it's really hard to verify the data. Even if you have speakers, sometimes it is still hard to verify the data depending on the speakers that you have on the language. For some languages, however, as is the case for Chimeric, archives are the only source of data that is available today to community members, because there are descendants of Chimeric speakers, so you do get tribal members, you just don't get speakers. And that data may be very valuable to those members, it just is very hard to work with in the state that it is available. Those archives generally contain lots of invaluable cultural material. Many of the linguists who worked on Chimeric, actually I'd say all of them, were also anthropologists, so they would collect rich cultural data. There's also historical information. But the data, you'll see in a moment why, is largely inaccessible to the community. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in order to process the data to make it more accessible. So this paper is mainly reporting on the process of reconstructing narratives from two different sources for the Chimeric language. And just a very brief overview of the language. Chimeric is a dormant language. It was last spoken in the early 20th century. So the data that I have is basically 100 years old or older. Epologically, just to give you an idea, it's synthetic to polysynthetic. It is headmarking language. It has a very interesting grammatical system, which is hierarchical, and agent-patient alignment system. There is also noun incorporation, and you will find case marking on instruments and companions, just to give you a little overview. Now, the data is very limited on the language, as you can imagine. There's some published and some unpublished materials. This is just to give you an idea. It's just to make things a little more complicated. Chimeric is an isolate, so there are no known relative languages, although it has been linked to Hokkien, which is a stock, including many languages in California and beyond. It was mainly spoken in the 19th century in a few small villages along the Trinity River and the New River in Northern California. It was basically an area where there was lots of gold mining, and once the miners came into that area, that tribe was virtually extinct. So this is the data that you will find today. This is all we have on the language. So a little bit of documentation in the late 19th century, most of it in the early 20th century. The data I've been working with is a grammar sketch and a few narratives collected by Roland Dixon, he's an anthropologist, in 1906. And then the most extensive source on Chimerico is the Harrington data from the early 20th century. And interestingly, if you just look at this page, the different anthropologists and linguists worked with many of the same speakers because there just weren't that many speakers left to begin with at the time the data was collected. And Polly Dyer, the woman that Dixon mostly worked with, was Sally Noble's mother. So they're also related family members. This is the Dixon grammatical sketch. It is a great source to begin with, but it lacks a lot of details, so you can't compare it to grammar as you would find it today. It's very sketchy, and one of the main problems it presents is that it is very flawed phonologically because Dixon wasn't a great phonetician and he really had a hard time hearing the sound, so you don't get an accurate phonemic system in the grammar, which obviously makes it a little harder to work with. And then the stories, just to give you an idea how the stories look like. So you have word by word translations for most of the stories. There are about six stories, and you don't have any grammatical glossing. And one of the stories is missing the translation in that source. The most extensive and valuable material, I would say, is the Harrington material. It has an extensive corpus, and there's over 500 pages of just narratives, religious narratives, one after the other. Overall, there's 3,500 pages of data on the language. It's all handwritten. It has elicited sentences, word paradigms, lexical items of translation, some grammatical analysis, not too much, and some textual material. Now, the great thing about the Harrington data is he really had a good ear for phonetics, so he really wrote down the sounds very accurately, which was then very helpful in working out a phonemic system for the language. This is just to give you an idea how it looks like. I know it looks very scary, but once you get used to it, it's really not that bad. And this is actually a very, very nice page where he just writes, and that is a very, very nice page. So if I see one of those, like, great, I can work with that. It's very legible. So this is how the text would look like. This really nice page of the 500 pages, but I'll give you an idea. So both data sets, the Dixon and the Harrington material, they contain very valuable texts, some personal narratives, some myths, some stories relating to historic events, such as, for instance, a great flood, which I think it can be linked to the great flood of the 1860s. And as I mentioned before, Dixon's consultant was the mother of Harrington's consultant. So interestingly, I would say Harrington's, so the daughter probably heard the stories from the mother. And Harrington re-elicited the same text that Dixon had already collected. So he basically re-elicited the stories from the daughter that she had heard from the mother. So this work is trying to combine all those sources into a single corpus of narratives, which would then hopefully be useful if the community would like to put together a language revitalization program or put some storybooks together for kids or whatever program they would like to develop for their language. So this is the process I'm presenting on here. So the first thing I will do, I will talk about is the phonological and orthographic adaptation of the two sources, connecting scattered pieces of narratives. Harrington would start a narrative on one page and maybe wander off on something else and then continue on a little later. To include interlinear glossing for the whole corpus and to fill in gaps of the translations where no translations were provided in the archival data. So first off, phonological and orthographic adaptation. Just to give you a sense how far off Dixon's phonology was. So Dixon, for instance, he didn't follow phonemic writing. He didn't have an accurate phonemic system. So his system has 24 phonemic consonants. And then Jenny in 2009 elaborated a phonemic system for the language based on the Harrington materials, coming up with 33 consonants where you have glottalized distinctions. So this will just give you an idea of the adaptation that needs to be done. So this is how one of the, and I have another slide that actually compares the original and this is the story how I would enter it into the corpus. So what I did try to do, I didn't want to completely dismiss the original source. So in the first line, I would still keep the original source spelling and orthographic and phonemic convention, just so that the original source is also represented in the data. I know you can probably not read this very well, but it gives a side-by-side comparison of the symbols being used in this work, the IPA, the Harrington. Grekov is another source, another linguist who worked on the language. Sapir is another one. It is just a comparison for all sources. Can be very useful when you work with different sources. So this is the original, how you have it in the original. Then below you see the beginning of the story and how you have it in the corpus. So the first line gives you the exact original. The second line gives you the morpheme by morpheme and already adapted orthography. And the third line gives you the glosses, and the fourth gives you the translation. Okay, so next thing, the Harrington data, as I mentioned before, he would have his data. It's very accurate and very detailed, but he would sometimes wander off on a subject and start writing about something else and then come back to the story a few pages later. So the first thing I wanted to do is to look at all those 540 pages and to get a sense what there actually is, what the stories are, what the contents are, if there are translations available, and if there's interlinear glossing, to what extent, and so forth. So I created like a little log for myself with the page on the reel, the text that is being talked about, and if there's some translation, what kind of translation, and some other comments, if it's legible, if it's really hard to read, and so forth. And then I also color-coded it in terms of which ones would be the easiest ones to work with. So I would start with the easier stories, which will then hopefully give me more to work with as I work on the harder ones. So I color-coded them and started off with the easier ones. You see some of the pages are already a little harder to read, but it is still one of the easier ones to read. So this textlet had lots of missing translations in the original, but I was able to pull together the translations from other stories I would have, from the grammar, through the glossing, and so forth. So the yellow ones are the missing translations that I filled in. And as I work on the corpus, I'd like to keep, to make sure that I have a distinction between which translations I have filled in and which translations I've just taken over from the original. So for now I have them color-coded. Later on I may do something else. Okay. So this is a grammar that I published for, it was basically the work of my dissertation. And it is very helpful because I can now go back and gloss the stories, and through the glossing I can add the interlinear translations and fill in some gaps and go back and forth. As I piece together more stories, I get more glosses. It's kind of like a little puzzle to work with, and it's actually very, very exciting work. Okay, limited material that there is available on the language, and so hopefully, I'm hoping that I can kind of add on a little corpus of narratives that are then, my idea is to put them on the web as PDF files that can be searchable and downloadable. Okay, so just to summarize a little bit, there's some challenges in this work. The Harrington material, you've seen the handwriting, that's one of the challenges, and then some of the translations are missing. There's no interlinear translations. There's scattered fragments of the same narratives. So you really have to piece it together like a puzzle. The Dixon material seems nice because it's all published, but there are phonemic inconsistencies, so sometimes you kind of have to take a guess on some words. Some translations are missing. There's no punctuation whatsoever in the Dixon material. There is in the Harrington material, which gives you a sense of prosody, but there is none in the Dixon material. So one idea is to compare some of the same stories, obviously told by the mother, and the stories told by the daughter. But the storylines are kind of scattered in Harrington, which makes it very difficult to do such a comparison. So once I have the whole corpus as a searchable corpus, I hope to be actually able to pinpoint to pieces in one narrative that then align with the pieces in the other narrative. So this is what I have to date. Corpus, I tried to divide it into kind of personal stories, stories relating to historic events, some myths, and some cultural practices. I have a total of about 45 pages of gloss narratives, so 23 gloss narratives. There's two texts that are very similar or identical in content, and the one thing I want to do is start off and comparing those two texts in the two sources and see how much they align, and also look at the grammatical content and so forth. So since I'm almost out of time, so what does this all mean for the community or for language revitalization? What can you do with all that? So what I'm hoping to do with this talk is to highlight the importance of archival material for language revitalization, especially for smaller languages, for dormant languages, where no other material is available. So I'm hoping by starting off to build an accessible corpus that then the community members or whoever is interested can work with will be helpful in those kinds of work. And I also want to highlight that archival data can provide a good record or a good start for linguistic work, and that it is very valuable linguistically and culturally. And there are some other communities who have used, with dormant languages, have used archival data in language revitalization. If any of you are working with such languages, I would really love to hear from you as well. So where to go from here? Although Chimeric is no longer spoken, there are several dozen tribal members that identify as Chimerico, been in contact via email with some, and I hope to do more of that. So hopefully by having a corpus, they can then use that in whichever way they wish for their community efforts. And by having the narratives a little more available as a narrative rather than this sketchy nature as it is here, I would hope that they can maybe do some booklets for kids or adolescents or adults or however they wish to work with that material. So, thank you.
We have over 10 minutes for questions, so would anybody like to begin? So you say there's people who identify as descendants. Mm-hmm. Is there any kind of like state recognition?
No, it's not. They're members of other tribes like the Hoopa and some other. other tribes. So we're already, I mean, back, the speakers were already multilingual, kind of belonging to different tribes, identifying as Chimerico and Hupa, Chimerico and Wintu, and so forth. Yeah, but there's no state recognition or federal recognition for this tribe.
Okay.
Of the Dixon and Harrington texts that you found were the same, how similar or how different were they? And if they're really different, how are you going to resolve that in your work?
Well, I'm hoping once I actually have the whole story. So one of the stories, the flood story, extends over, I think, 20 or 30 pages in the Harrington material. So once I have that one pieced together, because the Dixon one goes much faster. It's just basically orthographic adaptation, glossing. It's much faster than the Harrington, where you really have to find all the pieces. So once I have it, then I'm hoping to kind of start aligning pieces of the narratives that I see are similar, or start with the storyline, see if there's overlap in the vocabulary, in the grammatical structures, and kind of do a thorough analysis of two stories, one next to the other, and then see how much they actually align. So far, I haven't seen that much alignment actually in the content, so, but I haven't done the whole Harrington part yet.
Yeah.
With those descendants that you're working with, what have they stated as their end goals for revitalization? Like, what are they trying to accomplish?
Well, so far, talked about revitalization. I've just been asked for the materials that I have. So whenever I work on a few stories, I would just send off, hey, I have a Word document to additional stories if, you know, that's helpful to you. Because, I mean, it takes time. You don't want them to, okay, I'll give you everything in like 2 years. So as I have more, I kind of try and send it off. Been contacted by somebody, it was a few months ago, who asked if I had a log of that reel with the narrative, just to get a sense of the content. So I sent my color-coded one, the other one, to just so that they would get a sense of the content of the whole reel. Because it's really hard if you just look at the handwriting to even get a sense of what is in there in those 500 pages. So I think since they're not like an organized tribe, so they may be actually individuals who are more interested in finding stories about their relatives, or just interested in their ancestral language, and you know, just for personal kind of gain. But that's already valuable to me. If, I mean, I can see if somebody, you know, is a descendant and they have stories of their great grandfather in there. I mean, that's already very valuable. So I don't think that there is like an organized effort going on that I know of. Maybe more individual driven. Of certain individuals, so they may contact others they know of.
I'll ask a question now. I've been working on Shoshone stories, and one of them is Theft of Fire, so that was really, really interesting. And one of the things I've noticed, because we have stories told by different people, the same, it's supposed to be the same story, but they're never the same story. So I'm wondering how you, and I've seen some of the Harrington materials for Shoshone, so I really sympathize with how much work you have done. I want to say that too. So how are you dealing with the fact that different storytellers, even if they're mother and daughter, might tell the story in a different way, or that language may have changed from that older generation to the newer generation? What do you, how are you approaching this? Because it's very difficult, I would think.
That's one of the things I've tried to look at, see if there's any intergenerational language attrition going on. Now, if you say that the language changes from generation to generation, you would think that there would be like a vibrant speaker community where the language would change a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I think the daughter, the only source for the language she had was her mother. So the only thing I can think of in terms of change would be attrition. Mm-hmm. So not that she would be very creative with the language, but basically the only thing she has is a limited amount of what her mother had of the language. Now, Harrington really tried to re-elicit things. So I can see how Harrington would probably say something to the speaker at some point. Oh, wait a minute, you know, you're missing something. something, which may contribute also to having some scattered pieces where later on he may say, oh, wait a minute, I'm missing something. So what about this piece? And then that's how you have another piece, which is why I think you're right about that stories are never the same. But this makes me think that there are somewhat comparable because Harrington was really about reeliciting
mm-hmm.
things that he already had the data for.
That's really interesting. And we have more time. Any more questions?
And please do let me know if your work with archival material. I really love to hear what you can do, what you have accomplished. If you have language revitalization project through from archival material, I'd really love to hear about that.
Were there any particular aspects of the grammar of the language that you had a really hard time figuring out based on the material you had available?
Like when I did the grammar?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the grammatical system took a long time because it's just so specific. I mean, if you've worked with grammatical systems that are based on hierarchies or Asian patients, really very, very specific. Each language does its own thing. I mean, you have some similarities, but you actually have to try and figure out the very specifics. And if there's only so much data, you cannot test certain things. So you just have to try. And actually, Ray had published a grammar when I came across some new narrative data, and I said, wait a minute. No, this actually adds another piece to it. So I think I'm still discovering new things as I look at additional data and as I piece together narratives and say, wait a minute, this wasn't aligned with what I have in the grammar. Let me take another look at this.
I guess I'm wondering if there's anything that you just couldn't, like a part of the grammar that you knew must be there and you just couldn't find evidence for it in the kinds of materials that they provided.
Well, one thing, obviously, I don't have any conversational data. So you have one type, it's just elicitation, it's just one type of narrative, so just, you know, oral narratives. So I say, like, interaction-wise, you don't really get that interaction between speakers, prosodic elements. So obviously there's some limitations there, just the pure phonetic data.
I just want to say that I find this really interesting. I have a daughter, a linguist, and a speaker, and they've been actually doing somewhat reverse work where they have, they're working on oral histories that there's no copy of or no known version that is in the language, but there have been English translations that have been published by I believe Kennedy and Bouchard and I can't remember his name. It's gonna come to me later when I least need want it. But then working with, luckily having a couple speakers in the area where they can sort of, in a group mind effort, sort of stitch back the stories into sort of how they were most likely told.
That's all right.
And so I find this really.
So starting off with the English and then trying to reconstruct it.
Yeah, doing their best to sort of do a reconstruction, and sort of the community that they work with is actually really lucky in that there are 12 speakers in, I think, about 350 people, you know, well over the age of 65, mostly over the age of 70. It's sort of, most communities have maybe one, two, comparably speaking. I missed the first little bit. So the only thing that you have to work with is sort of stories, no sort of conversational.
No conversational data. You have some elicitation of verb paradigms, elicitation of individual sentences. So I guess you go how you say this, how you say that. But you don't have any conversational data.
That's a shame.
That is a shame.
Are there many speakers around at all?
There are no speakers. So the last speakers passed away about 100 years, almost 100 years ago.
Okay, so anybody with any sort of conversational proficiency.
And even back 100 years ago, their conversational proficiency is probably very, very limited because there wasn't a vibrant speech community, so they didn't really have anyone to talk to. It's just what they would have in their memory. So somebody sitting down with, I guess, an elderly woman, okay, so tell me stories in the language that you may, you know, spoke, I don't know how many decades ago. So there's already language attrition going on as the data is being collected.
Thank you.